Hello, this is the Smiling Conscious Traveler Podcast. I am Ottmar Brauniker from Austria, and my guest today is Jamal Ali from Cincinnati, Ohio in the United States. Jamal describes himself as a son, father, and grandfather. He's also an Amazon best-selling author, keynote speaker, success coach, and since a couple of weeks, also a podcaster. Welcome, Jamal, to my show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to me. And I really appreciate that it was such on a short notice that you joined me. I really appreciate that you're so spontaneous.
Well, you know, they say timing is everything in life. So it was great timing that when you asked, and it was great timing that I was available. So it all worked.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
So you say that you're an Amazon best-selling author. What role does Gary Robert play in this journey, and how did you get there?
Gary Robert?
You might want to know how I figured that out. I watched a couple of YouTube videos.
Yes. Writing is something that I was always told that I'd be good at. In fact, my fourth grade teacher, this goes way back a long time. My fourth grade English teacher told me that one day you're going to be a great writer. And of course, being in the fourth grade, it just didn't register, right? And so, but I've always kind of had a way with words and the spoken word and the written word, but I never really did anything with it from a professional standpoint. But once I began speaking, everybody told me that you need to write a book. And I was like, okay, well, I kept hearing this so many times. I said, well, I guess I need to write a book. And so after I wrote the book, then people started telling me, well, you really don't need a book. I was like, come on, which is it? Do I need a book or do I not need a book, right? So, but yeah, I wrote my first book called From Broke to Bentley, My Journey to Success. And I wrote that in mind with thinking that it would be a book series of three. I've got the second book about 90% complete, so hopefully I'll be rolling that out in the next couple of months or so. And then the third book will follow that up. And I think I'll be done with my book writing days at that particular point. But it's great therapy. I learned a lot about myself, and it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And the book has been well received.
We definitely have to talk about this again because I want to write books too. And
okay.
I had the same question on my mind. Nowadays, everybody is watching videos, is on social media and all this stuff. And people are telling me nobody is reading books, but that is not true. Maybe people are not reading so much anymore, but they are listening to audiobooks, and you can make different versions, obviously.
True. Very true.
So I like that a lot, that you're not only reading, but that you're also writing.
Yeah. Well, you know, Amazon Kindle is very robust at this particular time. So people are reading, and they're definitely listening to audiobooks, but they're also downloading and reading books on Kindle. So versus a physical book in their hands, they're reading online. So reading is still king in my opinion.
Yeah. You can get way more information than you could get through other medias.
It's more engaging to a sense because you got a lot of things going on. You have the visual where you actually looking at the book and processing the words, and you're holding the book, and you know, so you got this interaction going on with the book that makes it a little more romantic, I think, and a little more personal. And you know, I don't think you get as distracted when you're doing a lot of things online. You tend to have some other stuff going on online as well. So yeah, I think there'll always be a diehard core of people that will always prefer to just read a book. Like me, I prefer to have a hard copy book in my hand versus reading one online. It's just something about holding the book, you know. I really like that.
I figured out a lot of more through your YouTube channel, and I just remembered that you said in one of your videos that you were born in 1956, and I was really amazed because I said this guy looks much younger. And I remembered it now because you were talking about books and the feeling, and I'm 43 years old, so I'm okay. Somehow not the same generation, but I grew up with books too, and I think it's so much a different feeling if you really have a hard copy book in your hand than just an electronic device.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just switch off every distraction, just go offline with the book.
Exactly.
And that's what you described as romantic. I can really feel it.
Yeah, it is. It's just something about it, you know, and I guess everybody doesn't feel that way. For the people who like to read online, they certainly wouldn't have that particular thought about it. But again, there's a core group of us who just want to have a book in our hands. I'm in that group. Yeah.
Yeah, there's so much to say about you. And I want to talk also about, you mentioned that you're a keynote speaker. And I figured out too that there was playing Lisa Nichols and Les Brown role in your life.
Yes.
How does this come into place with the keynote speaker? I think this has to do something with that.
Yes. Well, you know, I Les Brown is one of my teachers. As a matter of fact, I have him on speed dial on my phone. And so I had this bug that I wanted to speak, you know, 15 years ago. But I just didn't know how to do it and how I would break into it and, you know, what do I do? And so I went to this conference. And young lady was bugging me about going to this conference. You know, you got to go see this particular speaker. He's a dynamite guy. And I really didn't want to go. And I just went to appease her keep her from bugging the heck out of me. She was just driving me crazy about this particular conference. So I went to the conference and I didn't go in any of the breakout sessions. I just kind of hung around the lobby and drank coffee and fellowship with people and network with people. But towards the end of the day, I went in one particular a breakout session where George Frazier was speaking. And he was so cool. He was so smooth. He was so eloquent. And he just mesmerized me. I don't know what he did for everybody else, but he just mesmerized me. And I was like, wow. He had such a command of his words, of his content, and of the room. You could tell he was just in control. And I was like, wow, this is dynamite. You know, I want to do this one day. And so after his speech, I walked up to him when I got a chance to introduce myself. I said, man, I love your speech and I want to speak one day. I said, well, how do I break into the industry? He says, well, one of the best things you can do is volunteer. It's like, really? He said, yeah, just volunteer for some speaking engagement. He says, as a matter of fact, why don't you pick up my briefcase right there and follow me to my limousine? That was my first volunteer job in the speaking industry. He had a bunch of other stuff in his hand. So I grabbed his briefcase and it was on wheels. And I walked with him outside.
Good for you that it was on wheels.
Yes. It was quite heavy. He had some stuff in there, right? And so we went out to his limousine and he loaded his cargo in there. He says, well, listen, I put on a networking conference every year. It's called FrazierNet. It's one of the largest African-American networking conferences in the United States. And so he says, look, I got a spot for you to volunteer. If you'll pay your way there, I'll take care of everything else. I'll put you up for your housing, your food, everything. And so that was like 7 months away. And so I did it, man. I booked my ticket and I went there and it was amazing. It was maybe 1,500 people there throughout the course of the 4 days. Mm. And I met some Magic Johnson. I met Don King. Don King was the keynote speaker that actually closed that particular event out. But Mike Tyson was just all these stars, and it was amazing. And so I left
there
and
went back to getting Atlanta. Really amazed when you're just telling me.
Yeah, it was amazing because I was meeting people and rubbing up against people that I seen on TV and all these, and I was like, wow, I'm actually here with them, right? And I was kind of starstruck, and I'm really not that type of guy, but it was just amazing to be in that kind of space in that environment. So I got the buzz that I got to do something big with my life. I got to, you know, I got to get off of this mediocre, everyday working 9-to-5 type of life, you know, and live like these guys and girls, right?
I liked it.
So I went back home, and you know, life got in the way, and I really didn't do anything. And so I started watching YouTube videos of people speaking, and then I picked up on Les Brown, and he was just mesmerizing as well. So after watching a lot of different videos, I kept coming back to Les, kept coming back to Les. It was something about his style and his whole story, and he just captured me. So lo and behold, one day while at work, I was assistant valet manager at the Four Seasons Hotel in Atlanta, Georgia. And Les Brown is coming down the stairway in the hotel. And I'm looking, whoa, that's Les Brown? And so I approached him from a distance. I said, hey, Les, how you doing? You know, maybe 20 yards away. And he kind of looked at me like, who is this guy, right? Who is this strange character, right? But he was so smooth, and he kind of played it off and said, hey, how you doing, right? And so I got a little closer. I said, listen, man, I love your work. I said, I want to speak just like you one day. He says, get out of here, man. He said, everybody tell me that. You don't want to do nothing. I said, no, I'm serious, man. I love what you do, and I want to be a speaker one day. So he said, well, I'll tell you what to do. He said, go to my website, and I'll be back in town in a couple of weeks. Go to my website, look around, and when I get back in town, tell me what you think. So he comes back a couple of weeks later, and he said, hey, did you look at the website? I said, yes, I did. And I said, well, he said, what did you think? I said, you way out of my league. I said, man, I can't afford you. I said, because everything on his website was like, I think the least expensive course was like $6,000. So it went from $6,000 to $9,000 to $12,000 to $20,000. I was like, I'm just an average working guy. And so he said, look, man, let me show you something. So he took me to the back of his limo, and he pulled out his contract that he was getting to speak for that night in the Georgia Dome in Atlanta. This was a historic speech that Les Brown gave out of hundreds of speeches that he's given.
I think so I saw a video about that when he was there.
Yes, yes. So I was having a conversation with him hours before that particular speech. And he showed me his particular contract in terms of what he was getting paid for that night. And it just absolutely blew me away. It was $80,000.
One night speaking.
One
night.
1 hour and a half. Right? So it was 80,000 people in the Georgia Dome. So I guess it was a dollar a person. But it was mind-boggling. So again, years go by, and I'm not speaking, but I'm kind of picking up some things here and there. And I finally ran across Lisa Nichols, because I'm continuing to look at other videos. And Les and I just kept missing each other. Times when I had money to get in one of his smaller courses, for some reason, I never could connect with him. And then I would go off and do something else and spend the money, and then he comes around, and now I don't have the money. So we just kept missing each other for a couple of years like that. Yeah. And so I ran across Lisa Nichols on YouTube as well. In the same type of situation, she just floored me with her eloquence and her command. And so I actually went to a conference that she gave, volunteering, went to a conference that she gave in Atlanta, and the rest is history. I was bitten. Watching her maneuver on stage, and during the course of that weekend, it was about a four-day weekend as well. And a lot of other speakers addressed the stage, And I just got a chance to see different speakers and the way that they did things. And so I was bitten. And from that particular point, I bought one of her courses and went home and delved into it and dived in. Man, it was I was like a kid in a candy store. Mm. And so what I learned from Lisa gave me the confidence to really get out there and promote myself as a speaker. And because of that particular conference, I met one of Lisa's students who was giving her own conference the following year in Atlanta, and she asked me would I be with one of her speakers. Mm. And I said, sure. Now, I had never spoken professionally in front of a crowd, right? You know, I did some stuff with Toastmasters and this, that kind of thing. And so the next year, October of that year, I spoke at her conference. It was an all-women's conference. I was the only male there. And I absolutely blew them away. And I still can't believe it to this day, because the techniques that Lisa taught me, the techniques that Les Brown taught me, I put all those into action. And what Les showed me is that you got to practice, 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 practice. You got to make your speech look like it's just normal talking, right? But everything in your speech is practice, everything. From your laughter to anything that you do, you practice it, right?
Yes.
And so I was scared. I was so nervous, because I'm saying now, I'm gonna be in front of all these high power women. If I screw this thing up, man, they're gonna roast my butt, right? So I said, I'm gonna control what I can control. Mm. And a part of my brand is you mentioned dressing earlier. A part of my brand is that when I go out on stage, I'm going to be sharp. I'm going to be sharp from head to toe. For number one, I love dressing. And so this gives me an opportunity to show off, kind of, so to speak, right? And so I was clean. I was sharp. And, you know, what woman doesn't like a sharply dressed man, right?
Of course.
And so, and I knew my content inside and out. And so I was sharply dressed. And I was professional with my content. And those two things there, which allowed my personality to just come out. I could just be me. Yeah. And the women just went nuts. They really appreciated me being there, because what they said was that we hear women speak all the time. Mm. So it was a breath of fresh air to hear something from a man's point of view, right? And they all told me, you should concentrate on speaking to women. I was like, wow, maybe I should do that. So that's when I heard that you should write a book. So all these women told me I should write a book. So I ended up writing a book. But long story short, that particular event launched my speaking career. Mm. And it's been a beautiful thing ever since.
I love really the part that you really say, you should, and you did it.
Yes, that, yes.
Mm-hmm. That is what I love about you, that you really yes. do it, what not only what people are telling you, but what you're telling yourself.
Exactly. And let me add this, I did it with fear. I was scared.
But that is the important part. Do it.
Yeah, I was scared anyway. Because it was the unknown.
Do it anyway.
Right. Mm-hmm. Even Les Brown. Now, he told me himself that night, even though he had given hundreds of speeches, and at that point probably had made $40, $50 million in his career. But he said every time he goes on stage, he's nervous. So, you know, it's just part of the process. So fears that you're ready to perform. Because it lets you know that you're ready to perform. So if you're not feeling those butterflies and things of that nature, you're probably not going to do too well. When you feel those butterflies, a lot of times we associate that with fear, but really, that's a certain type of energy that lets you know you're ready for the competition. You're ready for whatever's getting ready to happen. I'm ready. So so you want to feel that.
Thank you for that. I'm just feeling the butterflies. No, but thank you that you said it this way. I know it, but thank you for reminding me.
My pleasure.
I just remember that before I figured out that when you actually, when I saw it on one of your YouTube videos that Les Brown was your mentor, I thought, this guy talks like Les Brown. And later a business partner in a video said that Les Brown was your mentor. And I said, okay, there you got it. Now I know why he talks like that. And even I figured out that you actually must have lived in Atlanta before, because now you're living in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I lived in Atlanta for 20 years. I was actually born in the state of Georgia, in Macon, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And so I moved to Atlanta in 1998. Mm-hmm. And I left in January. I moved to Atlanta in January 1998. And I moved back to Cincinnati, which is where I was raised, in January 2018, so 20 years. And I came home because I lost my stepdad in 2018. And me being the oldest son and the only son and the oldest child, I have a sister. You know, when I came home for the funeral, it was apparent that my mother needed me. So I went back to Atlanta and did what I had to do to come back to Cincinnati to be close to my mom. My mom is, at that time, she was 84. She's 86 now. But she needed her son. So I said, hey, you know, bye-bye Atlanta, you know. But I loved Atlanta. Atlanta's a great town.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You were actually also telling me prior to the interview that you're an avid reader of self-help books.
Yes.
How did this actually change your life?
Oh, man. You know, I think a lot of us have read the book Think and Grow Rich. If we haven't read it, we've at least heard about it, right? And so I read that book, man, years ago, and it just blew my mind. It gave me such a feeling that I could do anything that I wanted to do. And the words were just rebounding off my heart. And I was like, yeah, this is it. This is it. This is it. You know, so you hear this saying that, you know, knowledge is power. Mm. Well, that's not true. It's the application of the knowledge that leads to the power. Because many of the concepts that I learned in the book, I didn't apply them, so I didn't get any results, right? And so I just became an avid reader. I went from book to book to book to book to book to book because it just really spoke to my soul. It spoke to my intellect, and I just loved the words. And I guess this goes back to the idea that I'm a writer, you know. So the words have a way of communicating to you certain things more so than the word itself. So one word can bring out a lot of different things in you, right? And so so I just fell into that habit of reading self-help books because it just really expands the mind and this opens up a world of possibilities for you. But again, you have to apply what it is that you're reading, what it is that you're studying in order to get the results. So for many years, I was just an avid reader and I wasn't really benefiting by the information that I was reading.
Yeah.
You know, life gets in the way and you're doing this and you're doing that. And it's amazing. Everybody has their own journey because, you know, some people can pick up the book one time and get the benefits of it. Oprah Winfrey said she read it 22 times.
Oh,
imagine that. Oprah Winfrey said she read Think and Grow Rich 22 times. Because she wanted to get everything out of it that she could. And, you know, if you read a particular chapter, you don't retain everything in the chapter. But if you go back and read the chapter again, then you pick up some things that you didn't really notice the first time. So if you read the chapter the third time, so each time you read it, you're picking up something that you may have missed previously. So it's a great idea to reread these particular works, because you get something new out of them every time that you read them. So, so reading has really opened me up, and it's a hobby of mine. I just love reading. I feel energized. You get all these ideas, and you get a chance to be mentored and to be taught by people that you don't even have to meet. You can go pick up somebody's book whether it's Jim Rohn, he's, God bless his soul, he's passed away. He's one of my great authors as well. But Jim is my mentor. I've never met him, but I have his books. I have his tapes, you see? So he teaches me. And so that's a beautiful thing about books, is that you can partner with someone just by reading their book, and you never met them, but they can have an impact on your life. And so that's the power of books as well.
You just inspire me so much. That is actually why I want to write books too, because I want to be part of the life of other people. Because I think, yeah, I read a lot of things in books too, but I think I have a lot to share too. Because after, I mean, you are even 20 years older than me, so I guess you have also a lot of life experience and a lot to share. So,
well, that's true. But you'll be one. Here's one thing that I found. Prior to writing the book, my mentality and my mindset was, well, who would listen to me? You know, who am I to be writing a book, and who's going to listen to me?
That's the point. What keeps holds a lot of people back.
Yes. So the you don't have to be a star. You don't have to be well known. Just write the book, and once you write it, once you publish it, and once it's out there, the people who need to read it will find it and read it, and you're going to touch somebody. It may not be on a mass scale like the Les Browns of the world, or, you know, but somebody is going to read your book. It's, you know, when I went to the conference, Lisa Nichols conference, from that particular conference, I ran into a couple who teaches you how to write books. This is their expertise. And so teach you how to formulate it, how to, you know, get your ideas down on paper and bring it all together from start to finish, right? And so I went through this particular course to learn how to structure a book. And I wrote my book in 9 weeks, right? Wow. Now, had I not gone through this course, I probably still would have wrote the book, but I guarantee it wouldn't have been in 9 weeks.
It's not.
See, so from start to finish, in 9 weeks, I had a completed book, a best-selling Amazon best-selling book. So, and then from that, I went to a book signing extravaganza the following year in San Diego, where the young lady who had a particular course about writing books was doing a particular tour. And so I went out there on the tour as a and was promoted as, you know, this Amazon best-selling author, right? And so at another one of Lisa Nichols conferences. So when we were stationed in this particular room, we had our banners all up and, you know, our books on the table, and, you know, we were just kind of sitting around waiting on people, and they were still in these conferences. So we're just kind of out there. I was like, man, I came all the way to San Diego for nothing, and ain't nobody came by here to look at my book or nothing, right? But they were all inside the conference. When the conference broke out and people start walking by, oh, it was amazing. It was like I was a rock star, man. It was a line of people lined up to take a picture with me and get an autographed copy of my book. And I was like, whoa, this is exciting, man. It was such a great feeling. I was like, wow, I'm a celebrity.
Of course you are. You are. After all, you're on my show. You're a celebrity.
Amazing. And so just and that's for everybody out there listening. Just don't think about it too much. Just write the book. If you go to a bookstore, there's thousands of books in there. And at some point in time, somebody's going to purchase each one of those books that's in there, right? And so the point I'm making is you're going to give something to someone who's waiting on it. But if you never write the book, then they can't get what they need. You see? And so we got to show up in the world so that other people get what they need from us. So just think about all the things that you've bought over the years, whether it's a book or whatever. Mm. Somebody created something that was of value to you.
Yeah.
So if they didn't create it, then you wouldn't have some of those things, right? And so it's important that we share what it is that we have. We share our gifts for the benefit of others.
Mm. You really inspired me so much now. I will make this confession now, this statement now on this podcast. I want to finish a book this year.
It's a done deal.
I'm talking about years and years and years about this, and people are telling me, write a book about your stories and about your experiences. I will do it this year. I will write my first book this year.
Oh, awesome. We'll see.
So it's publicly recorded this podcast. I can't take it back anymore.
You can't take it back. Everybody heard you. And so I heard a little shift in your language. Listen to your language. At first you said, I want to write a book this year. And then shortly thereafter, you said, I will write a book. See, that's the language. I will write a book. Mm. See, wanting to and willing are two different things, right? And so you have to be definitive. And this is not directed at you, but everybody that's listening, you have to claim it. Mm. Just say what you're going to do and do it. Because when we want things, we usually don't get the things that we want. Right? Because we want them. No, we have to be what it is that we want in order for the thing that we want to come into our life. Right? And so the old song is, don't worry, be happy. Right? Mm. Don't worry, be happy. Mm. See, you have to be happy in order to be happy. That's the only way that you can be happy. So it's a choice that we make. So we have to be happy. We have to be healthy. We have to be whatever it is that we want to be. We have to be it first in our mentality. Now, of course, the language that you're hearing from me is from all the books that I've read. This is what the higher achievers in life, this is what they say. Mm. Not only is it what they say, this is what they do. So we have to be the thing that we want in order to get the thing that we want. So we have to be it first in order for it to come into our life. And the only way that you do that is through your mentality, right? And so the book says, think and grow rich. So the thinking comes before the growing rich,
yes.
Right? It doesn't say grow rich and think. Think and grow rich. Mm. So guess what? You can think and grow poor.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because it's all about the thinking. So whatever it is that you're thinking will tend to lead you in the direction of the thing that you're thinking about. So a lot of people think and remain poor because they have poor thoughts. You see.
Thank you for that clarification. I love it that you're so present and that you're really listening what I am saying to him. That mm-hmm. is what I love when I have a conversation that we're both present.
Yes, yes.
So I actually want to change the topic a little bit because mm-hmm. I want also to talk about your podcast and about actually want to change it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I understood that you called your podcast in the beginning African Diaspora Going Home Show.
Yes.
And then I saw today that there was written Black Magnificent TV.
Yes.
Where with mm-hmm. the subtitle, Where the Magnificence of Blackness Lives.
Mm-hmm.
Has this to do this change of the name with your wish to turn it into a media platform?
Yes, that's exactly to turn it into.
Let's talk first about what is actually about your podcast about.
Well, initially, African Diaspora Going Home, the motivation was to inspire, encourage, and motivate the Africans in the diaspora to go back home to Africa. So when we talk about diaspora, this is German. Every group of people on the planet has a diaspora. There are German diasporas, right? There are Austrian diaspora. There are English diaspora. So every group of people has someone who's left their homeland and now are in some other part of the world. And we refer to them as diaspora. So Africans in the diaspora, in this case, African Americans, are going back home to Africa to live. And so in 2019, the president of Ghana formally announced what he called the Year of Return, where Ghana actually marketed this particular concept in a global way, but mainly to the United States, the Year of Return, because it was the 400-year anniversary of slaves being taken from the shores of Africa. So 400 years later, the president of Ghana said, look, come on back home. Come back home. This is the Year of Return. And so I thought that was a marvelous thing. And it really captured the people across the United States. And a lot of people went to visit. And out of those visitors, a lot of people came back home and actually went to Ghana and are living there now. So and a lot of people are slowly but surely following suit. And not only in Ghana, but in other parts of Africa as well. The Gambia, which is where I want to go, or I am going in December. Senegal, Uganda, Kenya, Rwanda. And so you have Africans in America that are going to these particular places to visit first to determine if they want to live there. And some of them go to multiple countries before they find out which particular country they want to live in. But the reality is that African-Americans are going back home and living in Africa. So when I seen this information, I was like, wow, this is powerful. I need to get into this conversation. I need to be a part of this movement. And so that's why I created the podcast, African Diaspora Going Home. And once it was completed and I started getting some traction there, I had a dream just a couple of weeks ago, and in the dream, it was really powerful, but a voice came to me and said, you need to change African Diaspora Going Home to Blacknificent TV. Mm. So Blacknificent TV is going to encompass a lot of different things. It'll be an umbrella where African Diaspora Going Home and other topics can live under. And so I was inspired to do that. And I just listened to the voice in the dream to tell me that, because I like I told him with the voice in the dream, I said, look, I'm just learning how to podcast. I don't know what the hell I'm doing with podcasting yet. So hold up a little bit. Right. So the voice was like, no, you need to do it. In fact, the voice gave me the name itself. Mm. So I was like, wow. Okay. Let me just listen. So now that gives me the ability to not focus solely on information centered around repatriating to Africa, but a lot of different conversations such as fashion, culture, politics, relationships, all these types of things that we can bring into the picture now under the banner of Blacknificent TV, where the magnificence of Blackness lives. So the idea is to showcase and highlight the major and powerful, magnificent contributions that Africans, wherever you find them on the planet, have made to the world. So I couldn't do that with just African Diaspora Going Home. I would have to kind of stay in that particular bubble, if you will. So, but with Blacknificent TV, now it frees me up to bring a lot more content and information into the mix.
Yeah, I get it now. I had the feeling that it had to do with this wish to build a media platform.
Yes. So the idea is I want to be able to, you know, as podcasters, you know, if you're doing a couple of episodes a week, that can be a lot. depending on what else you got going. If you got a family and those types of things, man, it's hard to create content and get it out there on a consistent basis. So with Blacknificent TV, I want to be able to offer content 7 days a week.
Yeah.
So, and there's no way I can do that by myself. So I had to partner with other people. So I'm looking for talent in these places that I mentioned. I'm looking for talent in Ghana, Uganda, Nigeria, Kenya, Senegal. I'm looking for talent there that can, that are content creators that can come on the platform and give the content that the channel wants to be known for. And like I mentioned, you know, politics, relationships, culture, food, those types of things that would be interesting to the viewer in different parts of the African continent. So that's why I say now I'm a media company versus just a podcaster, because I'm bringing other talent in to help with the creation of the content. And we're talking about a lot of different things, just like watching the news. You know, you watch a 30-minute segment of the news, you get the news, you get the weather, you get, you know, who got murdered today, you know, so you get all this stuff, right? And so we want to be able to, every day of the week, we want to bring somebody in from, like on Mondays, it's the correspondent from Kenya. On Tuesdays, it's Uganda, right? And so every day of the week, we're bringing somebody in to deliver their particular content from their region of Africa. And then now that frees me up to do just one interview per week with my particular guest. And so now I only have one day a week that I need to actually interview now, because I got six other partners who are offering content six days out of the week. So it makes it very, very powerful. And then, you know, the idea is that hopefully I can find some people that's four or five times sharper than myself, you know, that can really drive this.
If this is possible, idea. I don't know. Because I figured out that you're quite sharp guy.
Well, I appreciate that, man. Thank you so much. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the idea behind Blacknificent TV.
But I can tell you from my experience, there are a lot of creative, sharp people in all those countries. And they are, if I can say it with Les Brown's words, they are hungry.
Yes, yes.
Not for food only, but for what you want to offer them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
They want to get their word out, and there are a lot of creative people.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
I mean, beautiful. I figured it out too when I had the other day, I had an interview with Rania Odaimat, a fellow podcaster from us. She lives in Ghana, in Accra.
Yes.
And she was talking about that hidden, somehow lost human potential in her country.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
that fits perfectly together with that what you said now, that there is a lot of potential there. Or actually, you still didn't say that today, but I think you have to you have some things to say about that too.
For sure. You know, as a keynote speaker, I have two main topics that I speak on, and one of the names of this it's called Chicken and Eagles. And this is a concept centered around living life to your fullest potential. So a chicken is a bird. An eagle is a bird. But the eagle is considered to be the baddest of all birds, right? Yeah. So the eagle charts its own course. The eagle is the leader. The eagle does his or her own thing, whereas the chicken is just an everyday lowly bird just walking around and really not, doesn't have a lot of value and as birds go, right? And so if you're a bird, you want to be an eagle.
Yeah.
And the idea is that every chicken has the ability to be an eagle, but most of them just don't know it. And so most chickens live their lives on the ground, never taking flight, never reaching their full potential and becoming an eagle. And so it's the same scenario. We're talking about birds and we're using that as an example, but the human being, most human beings act like chickens when they are in fact eagles. Most human beings don't live their full potential. And so we have to put them in a position where they understand that, hey, there's so much more that I can do than I'm currently doing. I can really elevate my life, and I should elevate my life for the benefit of myself and for others. And so as human beings, we want to be able to, as Les Brown says, what's the phrase? I love this particular phrase, man. It says, live full and die empty.
Yeah, I remember that now.
Full life, right? And when you die, you just want to have an empty gas tank. I done got everything out of me that I can get out of me, right? Mm. Live full and die empty. So we should be striving to do that as human beings to really get the full potential. The gifts that God has given us, we got to use them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I figured out too, a lot of people in Africa, they don't know how to do that. So sometimes mm-hmm. it's a lack of resources in their life, but sometimes it's also that they just don't know how to do it.
You're exactly right. They don't know how to do it. And that's a part of my mission is to go to Africa and hold workshops and events where we can expose them to the potential. Mm. And it all starts with, again, think. So we got to change the thinking. Mm. So as a software engineer, you know that you design your software so that it performs certain functions, right? And so if I want a different outcome, then I have to change the software to get the desired outcome. So many Africans and people in general, not just Africans, people in general have been programmed with a type of software that allows them or controls them in such a way that they remain chickens all their lives instead of becoming the eagle that they are, you see? And so that's what the book Think and Grow Rich was so powerful, because it reprograms the mind. It changes your thinking so that you're thinking like an eagle now instead of a chicken, right? Mm. And so the Africans especially, because they've had so much taken away from them, so much hope, their ability to be empowered, all that's been taken away from for most of them. They have very little hope to be anything. They're just in survival mode, right? And so we have to, it's my goal to show them that there's another way. Mm. Because as long as Les Brown says, if you fall down and you land on your back, if you can look up, you can get up. Mm. So if you can look up, you can get up. So you have many people walking around in the world that are flat on their backs, metaphorically, and they remain on their backs. They never get up. Mm. And so a lot of times it's just a little word here and there, a little push here and there that can allow people to stand up straight, be themselves, then go out in the world and be what it is that God intended for them to be. But if you don't know that, then of course, you know, there's no way you can accomplish that. So we have to expose people to the information, the possibilities and the potential that they have as human beings.
Yeah, talking about information, let me read something what I wrote down before the interview.
Okay.
I remember the pictures, what I saw on TV in my childhood with starving kids from Africa, of course, be it in advertising for charities or in the news. And I bought it at this time. I think I was somehow brainwashed by the media. And oh my God, was I amazed when I heard that they have also schools and universities and even metropolitan areas with buzzing business districts.
Yes.
And when I lived in Kampala, the capital of Uganda, for 7 months, I saw it with my own eyes. So actually, you're saying it nicely in the introduction of your podcast. YouTubers, social media sites, bloggers, and podcasters are exposing a different Africa than what we see in mainstream media. Mainstream media are telling us lies about Africa. What
very much so.
Do you think about that, what I just said?
Well, it's you know, very true, but let's, you know, we can just stay right here in the United States. We only have to go to Africa. Mainstream media is telling you, telling Americans lies about America. Mainstream media is telling the Austrians lies about Austria.
So true. Right? I work for the Austrian Broadcasting Corporation. I know that what you say.
Yes. You see, so the media has a job to do. And that job is to deliver information. And the information that they deliver is to lead one down a particular path that they want you to go, not necessarily where you want to go. And so we've gotten to the point where we are open and we trust the media. So whatever the media says, we just go with it. And very few of us do any investigating on our own about the information that they're giving us, right? We just believe it. If they say it on the TV, we believe it. And what we're finding out is that after the fact, many times we find out that what they're saying is not true. So there are certainly kids in Africa who are starving. Hell, there's kids in Mississippi, in my country, in the state of Mississippi that are starving. There's some people right here in Cincinnati that are having a hard time, right? And so that is a reality where you have youth in Africa who are having it very, very, very hard. Many of them are dying from starvation. But then the other side of Africa, you have there's a booming population there. There, like you said, there's universities. There's an advanced society there, right? There are people who are eating 3 or 4 times a day and not starving, right? And so, but this is everywhere in the world. You know, in Austria, I'm sure that I've never been there, but I'm sure Austria has its own ghetto. Austria has its own homeless people. Everywhere you go, you have homeless people, right? And so the model in terms of how we're living as human beings is pretty much the same everywhere you go. Human beings are the same everywhere you go. And so it's funny how the media, as big as they are, is really small, because you only have a handful of people that control all the media, maybe 4 to 5 companies, right? That can control, that does control the media for the entire world, giving the same message. How is it now that in the Gambia, they're wearing face masks because of COVID-19? In Austria, I'm sure they're wearing face masks, right? So everywhere on the planet, everybody's got a face mask on. It's like it's been a mandate to wear a face mask because of COVID-19. Now, how did you get all this? How did you get this information across the entire world? Through the use of TV, radio, and the media, right? And so there are reports, because there's other media out there, like ourselves, podcasters, there's other media out there that's reporting different information, right? And so you have a group of people out there that's saying, wait, this COVID-19 thing is not exactly how y'all saying it is. But even some people hearing me say that right now will say, oh, you tripping, Jamal, you crazy, man. No, man, it's what they, me personally, I don't believe that. I don't believe the reports that we're getting in terms of the number of people that have died worldwide. I just don't believe that because I know with my age, I have firsthand experience in terms of how the media has lied to us over and over and over and over again, right? And so I don't trust them. And the thing about it is, and here's the dangerous part. If you watch a 30-minute newscast, in 30 minutes, they may give you 25 minutes of just BS, propaganda, and then you get 5 minutes of truth.
Yeah.
So you have to decipher, and discern the 5 minutes of truth out of the 25 minutes of BS.
That is. Yeah.
And so as a result of that, the most listeners are left confused. Really don't know what the hell is going on. Yeah.
Especially the last month, I was confused too. And I'm a media person, actually. I just said I'm working for the Austrian Broadcasting Corporation, and I have to make a clarification. I am not a content creator there. I'm a technician, a broadcast engineer. I think I could not work for this TV station if I would be a content creator.
Yes.
Because it goes so much against my beliefs that I say I can't be a journalist or someone who creates content for this TV station. Even I had a conversation with a coworker the other day about what she believes and about there was a live broadcast about the Chancellor of Austria was coming in front of the TV cameras and talking about these new laws that they passed the last couple of weeks or regulations that now a lot of people are coming from Croatia, from our neighbor country, and they have to make checkups at the border, and there are long traffic jams now and a lot of confusion, and that's why they need to clarify a lot of things. But the point is, the lady who is presenting, the moderator, or how do you call it, presenter, the journalist, the main journalist from this TV station, she was actually talking there, and oh my God, she was talking with this other woman, and it's getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And I said, oh my God, this woman, she is the one who is creating this fear-mongering news, actually. And she has the whole responsibility for this TV channel, actually.
Yes.
And she should actually know what she is doing there. And I think she knows what she's doing there. And I don't know what agenda is behind this. I know this woman in person. I mean, once I came into the TV station, she was wearing these face shields. And below the face shield, she was wearing some goggles. And I was standing there without the mask because it's not really mandatory, it's recommended at the TV station. But she was almost scared to death seeing me there without the mask. And this is so I really realized this woman, this journalist, who is the head journalist actually of this channel, really believes it.
Yes. Yes.
Otherwise, she couldn't do that job, actually, I think. She wouldn't believe it.
Right.
But she is also creating this fear atmosphere.
And that's the thing. So this fear has been generated, whether you listen to the news in Austria, whether you're listening to the news in Cincinnati, it's the same formula. It's everybody's promoting fear. And so when you look at it from that standpoint, it's clear to me that this is a concentrated effort on the part of the owners of the media to create what it is that they're creating. It's not by happenstance, you know, this is by design. So Yeah, so the media is very, very powerful in the way that they can manipulate and control the mind, or as we said earlier, talking about the software, is how they create the software that we end up responding to and reacting to based on what they have created, right? And so it's interesting. Very interesting.
Actually, this is what excites me so much, that you want to build a media platform, because there is not much real information on the internet about Africa.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, it is really, I mean, you find it on YouTube. You have to search for
yes.
it. But
yes.
People who don't search for it, they will never find it.
Never.
And
exactly.
That's actually why I think it's important to create something like a mainstream channel, but mm-hmm. with real information, not like the so-called mainstream media.
Right. Mm-hmm. I agree.
I mean, I saw it with my own eyes, and it's like you explained it. I lived about 500 meters away from the slums in Kampala. So I just turned to the right, I came to the slums. I turned to the left, I came to downtown.
Where
the business life. So the difference between Africa and Europe, I would describe it like this, because I'm living in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
There's more extremes.
In Europe or in
Africa?
Africa.
In yes. Uganda, yes. actually. I'm talking about Uganda because I didn't see whole Africa.
Okay.
But I think it's comparable to other African countries. And I saw really the extremes. You could really draw a sharp line in the city and say, okay, there's the slums and there's the rich people.
Right, right.
And I experienced that actually also in the United States, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
When you walk through the big cities, especially in New York, it was my first big city, and it was, I think, was it 95th Street or 96th Street or something like this, when starts Harlem. And you really could see it, that there was the line where the so-called poor people live, and Harlem seems to be also the place where a lot of African Americans live. So that has to do something, I think, together with African Americans poor, because it's, yeah, I think you can say more about that, why it is like that.
Well, it's by design as well. When you look at New York City, or any city actually, they're the way that they're mapped out in terms of where people live, it's they've gotten it down to a science. You know, Black people live over here. White people live over here. Jewish people live over here, right? The people with that makes $200,000 a year, they live over here. The people who are homeless, they live over here. So everybody's got their own area, right?
Yeah.
Based on who they are and what their financial position will allow. And it doesn't just happen like that. It's by design. So when you build communities, you build it based on demand that you create. So, you know, you build 500,000 houses over here. Well, we know only a certain amount of people can live over there, you know, in the areas where people are have very little money, you don't build anything there, right? And so nobody caters to the homeless, if you will. Nobody caters to the people who make that are living under the poverty level. They're working every day, they have a job, but they can't make ends meet. They're not making enough. So where they live is a totally different place from other. You see, so.
Yeah.
It's all by design. It doesn't just happen like that. And so it makes you wonder, well, who's doing the designing? Back in the day, there was a particular term where they called redlining. Redlining was system where they drew a line based on demographics of where African Americans lived. Mm. And in this particular area, the people in that area, they can't get mortgage loans. If they get mortgage loans, it's going to be, the interest rate is going to be 10 times higher than what somebody that's white would get. So in the African American community, your interest rate is going to be 18% on a house. Well, a white person comes in and get a house and they get 5%, right? So in African American neighborhood where it's redlined, a loaf of bread costs you $2. In the white community, it costs them $1.25. So they're making more money, and then they're spending less for the things that they need. So their ability to create wealth is way up here, whereas your ability to create wealth is way down here because you're paying more for everything that you need to begin with, and then you're getting less in terms of income to begin with. So this is all by design. It's a systematic approach that causes ghettos. Mm. It's a systematic approach that causes these types of communities, right? It's you know, in a sense, it's a diabolical plan that's in place that creates what it is that we see. So when you go to Silicon Valley, you know, how did this become Silicon Valley? How's everybody out there, you know, living in $10 million mansions and this type of thing, right? That's Silicon Valley, right? And so you go to Beverly Hills, you know, you got the movie stars and, but not too far from Beverly Hills, you know, you got folks that aren't doing too well, right? And so we live in a world where things are, let's just say, very, very interesting.
I just got a few things, really. I understood just a few things while you were explaining, because in Europe it's much more, it's not so sharp, the lines. Mm-hmm. And I think it has to do with the history of Europe. Mm-hmm. There is much longer history. I mean, United States has also a long history, but before the people came from Europe and from all over the world,
right,
were just the Native Americans there, and mm-hmm. they were basically wiped out after the Europeans came there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it was built from scratch.
Yes.
And I'm just seeing the facts now without any sentiments or something like that. Of course, mm-hmm. I feel that's a lot of things went wrong there, but I'm just saying now the facts, and now I understood, okay, they were building it from scratch and they could build it on the whiteboard somehow. Okay,
right, say, right.
There are the streets, mm-hmm. there are the houses, this is mm-hmm. the sector for the privileged white people, this is the sector for the slaves at this time.
Right, exactly.
400 exactly. years ago, African Americans mm-hmm. were slaves, actually.
That's right.
They were brought mm-hmm. from Africa. I mean, you said it actually also in your introduction of your podcast. I mm-hmm. was not really aware of that it's such a long time ago, that it's 400 years.
Yeah, 400 years. And actually, we say 400 years, but it's actually longer than that. It was the Europeans are associated with the 400 years. But prior to the Europeans, it was the Arabs. The Arabs actually invaded Africa and started the slave trade hundreds of years before the Europeans. Mm. It was just that the Europeans did it in a different way, kind of took it to another level, if you will. And so the slavery period is more associated with the Europeans in terms of what people are knowledgeable of. But the Arabs, till this day, mm-hmm. I'm talking about right now, are enslaving Africans.
I know.
So
I have experience. My wife has actually, her family experienced it actually, because mm-hmm. a lot of Ugandans, they go to countries like Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, And they're basically slaves there.
Yes, yes, yes.
I mean, they get some compensation for it, but they are treated like slaves.
They're treated like slaves, exactly. Exactly.
Well, it's still happening, and I can confirm what you just said.
As a matter of fact, I just seen on my Facebook page, there was a group of African Americans. I forget which country that they came from, but they were trying to make it to Greece, and they got close, but they're out in the ocean because the Greeks would not let them come to land. So the Africans are just out in the oceans, just swimming around. I think their ship ended up capsizing or whatnot. So, but the Greeks were saying, no, you're not coming here. So it's like, are you, you know, you serious? So not even enough humanity to say, okay, we're going to at least go out in the water and rescue them and bring them to shore. You know, y'all can't stay here, but, you know, we at least got you out of the water. But no, they just left them in the water. So you just, if you drown, you drown, you know? And so when you look at the inhumanity of what's being done to Africans everywhere on the planet, I did a podcast talking about the, did an episode talking about the number of Africans in the diaspora. And so most people don't know that in Brazil, Brazil has the largest population of Africans outside of Africa. We're talking about to the tune of like 85 million, maybe even close to 90, 95 million right now, right? So Africans are all over the place, you know, whether it be down under, you know, China, Japan, Vietnam, you know. So when we look at the history, Africans being the first people on the planet, then populated the rest of the planet. So Africans migrated from Africa to these other parts of the world. If you do your research, you will find out that the first samurai were black.
I didn't know that.
Yes, yes. Because they Africans migrated to those parts of the world, right? You have a great number of Africans in Mexico. You see, that's native. They ain't just moved there. They're native Mexicans, right? You have a population of black people with natural blonde hair and blue eyes in Australia. So black people have populated the world before any other people. So the history is there. And it's just interesting that we live in a time, this is 2020, where we still have other people oppressing black people around the world, whether in Africa, whether in the United States, you know, there was a gentleman that was shot in the back. I'm not too familiar with the story, but the police shot him in the back. I think he's paralyzed, and he was unarmed, running away from the police. So there's no threat. They shot him in the back. So this goes on every day in America.
Yeah.
Every day in America, black people are being treated like this. And so it's just amazing. And the only thing you can just ask the question, why? Why is it like that?
Let me ask you a personal question. How do you feel personally about that? I mean, you are obviously African American too, and your ancestors must have come somewhere away from Africa.
Man, you know, I get angry as hell. I get angry as hell because, you know, I keep asking the question, why? And no matter how you answer it, the answer is not satisfactory. Why? And that somebody has a mentality that they will just kill you based on the color of your skin, that you are mistreated, that you are maligned, you're discriminated against, all these things, right? Just based on the color of your skin. And so you, I asked the question, why? So when I hear some of these things, it makes me so angry, because it's like you're helpless to do anything. You know, we can't rise up as some African Americans say, it's time, we just gotta go to war. No, listen, we cannot fight the white, we can't fight white supremacy with weapons. Because they make all the damn weapons. they make the weapons that we even will even be fighting with, right? And so if a war started between us and them, it wouldn't be but a short period of time before we run out of ammunition, because we don't make, black folks don't make any ammunition. Mm. Black folks don't make any guns. So when the guns that you do have, when you shot all your bullets, then what? You can't get bullets anywhere else, right? And so we can't fight them in that particular manner, because they have more guns, they have bigger guns, and they have all the ammunition than we do, right? So that's just suicide that way. The only chance that we have is to outthink them. Think and grow free. We got to outthink the enemy, right? So it's not about fighting physically, because we're no match for them. Do you know there was a particular situation in 100 years ago in Oklahoma where it was called, research it out, it's called Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where you had about a neighborhood of about 6,500 black people.
Okay, I never heard about this story.
Yeah, search it out, Tulsa, Oklahoma and Black Wall Street. You got about 6,500 African-Americans that were well-to-do, self-sustained, had their own businesses, churches, schools, hospitals, transportation, everything that a society needs, banks. And they were down in a particular valley, and the white folks were up on the hills, looking down into the valley, looking at how prosperous black folks were. And of course they were jealous. And so one day, as the story goes, a black man came into the elevator where a white woman was operating the elevator. He was actually operating the elevator, but he went on a break. And as he came back into the elevator, he stumbled over the threshold and stumbled into the white woman. Well, the white woman wasn't told the other authorities that he assaulted her. And so without any investigation at all, the white folks took up arms. And later on that evening, the word got out that they were going looking for this guy, right? They're going to kill him. And so the word got out, the other black folks, they armed themselves. And now we got this war. We got a war going on in the United States between white people and black people in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hmm. Now, as the story goes, we black people were winning. We're holding their own against this group of white vigilantes, if you will, right? And so guess what happened? Because black people were winning, the United States government brought in the National Guard, as well as airplanes, and actually dropped a bomb. The United States government dropped a bomb on its own citizens in Tulsa, Oklahoma, right? We talking about 100 years ago to now. So here's a community of black people that ain't doing nothing, ain't hurt nobody, ain't no money, self-sufficient, that ends up getting a bomb dropped on them and destroy that community. So do your research on that, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Black Wall Street.
Definitely will do that.
Yeah, amazing, amazing story. So here we are 100 years later, and the same stuff is going on. Same type of stuff is going on. So But yeah, I know we've gotten far off topic, man. You got a couple of other
questions.
No,
it's okay. And yeah, I have to tell you, some people might have seen it, that my son just dropped in and that I was a little bit distracted. Actually, I'm here at home with my son.
Okay.
And yeah, he's now a podcast star too, because he drops from time to time in there.
He's learning the skills.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I tell you honestly, I was thinking about that. How should I handle this with my podcast as a dad of two little kids? And last week I had an interview with my mentor, Brandy Ridgway. And he told me, just tell the people you're a stay-at-home dad. And explains it. So why the kids are sometimes on the podcast.
Very natural. It's a very natural occurrence. So, and people will understand that. Yeah.
That takes the pressure out of it somehow.
Yes. Yes.
Sometimes we tend to try to make it as perfect as possible. But like my mentor says all the time, what if it's perfect already? Just see it from a different angle.
Yes. And I like to say it like this. It's perfect in its imperfection. It's the imperfection that makes it perfect. So however it is, it's perfect. That way it takes take all the pressure off of you. However it happens, it happens. So I made a decision when I first started podcasting. I said, you know what? I'm not editing anything.
Yeah.
I'm not going to edit. Whatever happens on my show, it just happens. You know.
I mean, let me be honest. I did it in the past. I edited a little bit when my son came in there.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was too distracting, but I think I will not do it anymore.
Yeah. And I love the idea what your mentor said, you know, just let people know up front, like, hey, I got two kids, and sometimes they might just drop in and say something. And so when it happens now, I guess there's no big deal, because you've already let people know that this might happen, right? And it's a good possibility that it might happen. So we live in a world today where people want you to be authentic. It's a different world now, man. Where social media, where people can come into your homes and just see you doing. Matter of fact, people bring you into their home. Hey, watch me cook up a meal, right?
Yeah.
You didn't even ask them. They just showing you. Hey, so people are bringing you into their space now, and whatever it is what it is. And so now we don't have to make excuses for things. We can just explain what's going on, and then everybody's okay with that nowadays.
I just realized. I think. People who are like 20 years younger than me, like let's say 20, 25, for them it's natural, because they grew up with all this media stuff, with internet, with phones and all this stuff.
Exactly.
But I guess you know what I'm talking about. We didn't really grow up with this.
No.
I'm born in 1977. You were born in 1956.
Yes. It takes a whole lot of getting used to for me, because it's certain we did things in a certain way. And so now I see us kind of bending the rules or breaking the rules. It's like, wait a minute, we don't do it like that. But no, it's okay. Really? Oh, okay. So it's hard for us to grasp that, because we know we come from another space, right?
Actually, I had to learn this first, even when I made my first live video. It was like, is anyone watching me? I just tried to find spaces where nobody could watch me. And now I'm doing it since 6 or 7 weeks, that I'm doing every day a live video in the morning. And it comes so natural now. And even I don't care anymore when people are watching me and seeing me. Even
Right.
I'm talking in a different language. I live here in Austria. I talk German usually, and then in my videos I talk in English. People are even more interested. What is this guy doing here?
Right.
Yeah, just doing it. The other day, last week, I was on a business trip in Vienna,
mm-hmm.
and I was even talking about controversial stuff.
Okay.
In the subway station, I mean, we even. That is really crazy. I have to tell it shortly. We even have to wear masks in subway stations.
Uh-huh.
And these are open air subway stations.
Right.
So
yeah.
They are open.
Mm-hmm.
There's coming fresh air in there.
Right.
You should wear
right.
masks there.
Make
so
no sense.
I said, it doesn't make sense to me. And
no,
I didn't
no.
comply with this rule. I even mm-hmm. took out my phone. I made a live video about it without a mask.
Yes.
And people were looking about this crazy guy, even he is taking out his phone,
right.
making a video about not mm-hmm. complying to this mm-hmm. mask rule.
Yeah.
And
it's
questioning
crazy.
This. And mm-hmm. I have quite a following that people are agreeing with my way of thinking. And
yes.
they were saying, thank you that you are such a woke person, and thank you mm-hmm. that you are waking people up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it, you know, it's very few people are. There's an old saying that about common sense, right? So if it was common, everybody would have it, right? But there's very little common sense these days, man. Mm-hmm. Common sense ain't common. So I'm seeing a guy going down the street just this morning. He's in his car.
Mm.
With a friend. Now they're in the car. Both of them have masks on. It's like in the car, just traveling down the road. I'm like, really? I mean, come on. You in the car. Where's it going to come from? Where's the corona going to come from? You know, if it's in your car already, then you're already done, right? So,
I mean,
oh my God.
I just remembered also last week in Vienna, I saw people with masks on the open
mm-hmm.
street.
Mm-hmm.
And then now it comes, they were walking, they're crossing the street on red
mm-hmm.
with the mask.
Right, right.
I said, okay, what is now more dangerous, the virus
right.
or the car which kills you because you're crossing on red? And I mean, they were crossing alone on the street,
right.
on the red light. So there was no virus, definitely. So the danger was more the cars which might hit them. Because, but
oh,
I learned man. Actually this in Uganda, it's more safe to cross on red.
Really?
Because people are crossing on red. Because
so
you're
more
attentive,
red, huh?
Because you're more focused when you're passing on red. So
yeah. Wow.
Anyway. Now I'm exposing myself that I'm crossing on red sometimes too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for me, it doesn't matter actually if I'm crossing on red or not. It's just use common sense, be focused, be present in life, then
mm-hmm.
you're aware of what is really dangerous.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
That is the point. I don't always have to comply to the rule. If it's the mask rule or the rule that I have to stop when the red light shows,
mm-hmm.
if I decide not to comply with this law, with this rule, then at least I should use common sense and I should be present to the situation.
Right.
Is it really dangerous?
Exactly. Yep.
And do I want to bear the consequences?
That's the thing. Do you want to bear the consequences? Because, I mean, we live in societies where we got to have rules and regulations and laws and things of that nature. Some of them don't make any sense. And the ones that don't make sense, we should be empowered as people to say, no, we don't like that. And that needs to be removed, right? But when the will of the people is not, isn't important, and the will of a few that is imposed upon the people, then that's a problem. You see, where I get it that wearing masks, the idea is it saves lives because it stops the spread of COVID, right? But then there's a ton of research out there that says, no, it does not. Because this is a virus And the virologists, the expert virologists who their expertise is in virology, they're saying that no. Because it can only travel a certain amount of feet in the air, right? And it ain't 6 feet. It ain't gonna travel no damn 6 feet, right? And so a lot of these precautions that we're being asked to take, they're not consistent with a virus.
There was even a virologist in Germany. He explained it very nicely. He said, it's like catching a mosquito with a fence.
Right.
Because the particles of this virus, most of the masks, I mean, there may be some masks which could avoid virus from spreading, mm-hmm. but the average mask, what people are wearing,
right,
is
doesn't do the job.
Yeah, I think the picture with the fence and the mosquito explains it very well, mm-hmm. that everyone mm-hmm. can understand it, what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm wondering just how many politicians are getting rich off of selling masks.
Hmm.
I was down in a bank warehouse
the other day. The chancellor in Austria is profiting mm-hmm. from this business.
Yes, yes. See, wearing
masks. The family, at least, from
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. a lot of politicians across the world are profiting from selling masks.
We just wanted to tell a story, I think.
Yeah, I was in a bank, the basement of a bank, making a delivery with a friend the other day, and here comes this truck driver in with about four skids of boxes. Each skid had boxes about 10 boxes high. Mm. So each skid had about 20 boxes on it, and it had three skids, 60 boxes of masks. Mm. And each box had like 100 masks in it, right? And I'm like, you know, so it's like, when is this thing going to end? I heard one politician say that we may never get over COVID. I'm saying, now, how can you make that kind of statement? Unless it's something that y'all plan on doing. We may never get over COVID.
Honestly, I was wondering when I will talk the first time on my podcast about COVID. And it's now mm-hmm. on the 9th episode that I really got into this topic now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I'll talk about it here and there, but I refuse to make it a topic.
No,
I'll talk about it to somebody, you know, we just get into a conversation, but I'm not going to have a show talking about COVID. I'm done. I'm sick. I'm sick of that. And again, not to downplay it, because there are some people who, I had a niece that came down with it. But here, listen to the story about my niece.
Yeah,
now, please. she was going to, because she was enrolling in college, one of the entrance requirements was to get tested.
Mm.
So she got tested before she could start her classes. And when she got tested, she tested positive for COVID. So she had to go into 14 days of quarantine, right? So on the 15th day, the clinic called her and just did an interview with her over the phone. And said, "Oh yeah, you're okay now." I'm like, "Wait a minute! she tested positive for COVID, so y'all did a physical test to determine that she had it, but you're gonna tell her over the phone that it's okay now? Doesn't make sense, right?" So I'm like, "Wait a minute!" So my sister, her mother was like, "No! We're not gonna wait. We're going to get tested to make sure you don't have it, right?" But they were gonna be okay with just saying, "Okay, everything's fine now, you can go back to work, you can go back to school, whatever." So again, it's just so much about this thing, man, that doesn't make any sense. So I refuse to give it life. I refuse to, because there's enough conversation of it about there without me adding into it, so.
But there's two more things what I want to say to that. There is, The Minister of Health in Germany even said it. Mm-hmm. That is a 50% chance that we get false positives with this test.
Yes.
So I just could gamble about it. It would be, give me the same result. I just flip a coin and then I know if it's positive or negative.
Right.
And the other thing is what is going on just right now in Germany, because I was just talking about Germany, and you might have realized by now that there's a lot of things going on in Germany about demonstrations. And on 1st of August, there was a big demonstration in Berlin, and mm-hmm. tomorrow they canceled it, actually, the authorities.
Okay. Okay.
How do you say, the chief of the police in Berlin,
mm-hmm.
3 days ago, he said it's not permitted. Not allowed to have this. It was officially a registered demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
And now he says, the reason is because he thinks that the people will not comply to the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Now I repeat it again. He thinks people will not comply to the rules. And it's a democracy in Germany.
Right.
There's even written in the constitutional law that mm-hmm. they have to give them the chance to demonstrate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But unless
you know, there's a lot of lawyers now mm-hmm. running errands and yeah. sending the best people to the Supreme Court in Germany to mm-hmm. file law cases.
Yeah. Well, let's just let you know, man, democracy itself is a farce.
Mm.
The democracy itself is a farce in terms of how it's being implemented now. In its ideology, it may be something great, but you when you force democracy on the people, then it's not democracy.
Mm.
So you have the United States government and others who force democracy on lesser countries. So no, this is the way you're going to run your country.
But the point is.
Yeah. You see what I'm saying? So let's look at Libya and Muammar Gaddafi. Whatever you thought of him, it don't matter. The people in his country, 88% of the people in his country had approved of his leadership. 88%. It was only 12% of the population to say, we don't like this guy. So here the United States comes in with Britain and they topples him, murders him, and force democracy on their form of democracy on Libya. So now that Gaddafi is out of the way, Libya is a war-torn shell of what it once was. Libya was a thriving economy under Gaddafi. Now you have, it's a total mess. Now that Gaddafi's gone, the United States and Britain and their allies, they just left Libya, the Libyans defend for themselves, right? And so what was the mission to begin with? If now that Gaddafi's out of the way, now you're letting the Libyan people defend for themselves, and where they have no government, no democracy, no republic, they have nothing.
Mm.
So in the name of democracy, you go in and destroy a country, and then you just leave, basically.
It was never about democracy. I never believed it, actually.
Exactly. It was never about that to begin with. So, but that's a whole other story. So yeah, man, we're living in some very, very interesting times. And I think that we have to educate ourselves as much as we possibly can off of the grid, away from mainstream, because it is the mainstream that programs the mind with propaganda that makes us think that what's black is white and what's white is black, right? So my point is, the things that you think it's one way when it's actually another way,
yeah.
Right? So very, very interesting, man.
So let me just say one last thing to Germany. I really encourage people to watch tomorrow all the live streams from Berlin.
Okay.
Because I'm definitely sure it will take place illegally or legally, no matter what. And they are expected 5 million people tomorrow in Berlin from all over Europe.
Wow.
And yeah, even the John F., not John F. Kennedy, but the junior from John F. Kennedy. Yeah.
Robert Kennedy Jr.
He's expected there.
Yeah.
How do you say, his manager or the press release was there, it was confirmed that he will be there tomorrow. So
yes,
it will be really a historical event, I'm definitely sure. And don't watch mainstream media, they will just tell you lies to from tomorrow's event.
Right, yeah.
Like they did it last time too.
Well, I'll wait to get the information from you.
And the other thing is, yeah, I want to come back to your endeavor. I'm really waiting to see your media platform grow. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, where can people actually find you?
Well, right now we're on Facebook, of course, at Blacknificent TV. Mm-hmm. And you can find us under the group African Diaspora Going Home. Mm-hmm. You can find us under that. If you type that in, your Blacknificent TV will come up as well. Now, I just got my domains for YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter, but they all, you should be able to get to all of them from Blacknificent TV. Mm-hmm. If you type in /Twitter or /YouTube.
I will put all these links in the description of this,
episode. I'll send you the link descriptions, the addresses. And then you can and then you can post them, so they'll be correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It was really a great interview, and it was so interesting to have a conversation with you. And I want to thank you again that you took the time.
Well, it's always a pleasure. I'm humbled that you would ask me to be on. On your show and to contribute whatever it is that I can contribute. I'm really humbled and pleased that you asked me to do so. So anytime that you want me back, just let me know.
Definitely, I will let you know. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my brother. All right. Peace and love, man.
Bye-bye. Peace and love. Bye.